So anytime, oh, and by the way, I'm up here because Domyo's at Rahatsu Seshin up at Great Vow Monastery. I'm sure everybody knew that, but I just want to clarify. It's like, why is this Yahoo in the seat? Domyo's supposed to be in. And anytime anyone gets up here to say words, no matter who they are, we're always just speaking from our own perspective, even Domyo, even seasoned, veteran-wise Zen teachers. They may be able to weave in core Buddhist teachings a little better than most of us, but they're still just sharing their own practice. And so obviously that's all I can do today. I can do less skillfully than Domyo, but I'm going to give it my best shot. Whether I say something that resonates with you, that you appreciate, or maybe you walk away thinking that guy's full of shit, which is entirely likely, either way, you've learned something about your own practice, I would guess, whether it's for good or bad. And again, pardon my reading from notes. If I start improvising, we'll be here all day. And you'll have to pull me off, like back in the old days, they'd pull out a cane and pull you out. They should make the gong show and hit the gong. I was making references that are like way dated, I guess. I should. Anybody who doesn't remember either one of those things is like, what the hell are you talking about, dude? Anyway, so I know there's a little bit of a mixed reaction to koans in general in our Sangha. Some I've heard are indifferent to them. I think I've actually heard of people say, I hate them. I know some are indifferent. Others find them interesting. If you're like me, you absolutely love them and you feel like you glean a lot from them. It makes sense if you're not really fond of them. The classic koan collections of the Gateless Gate and the Hekigan Roku and all those. And even the one that's closest to our tradition, the Shoyu Roku, or the Book of Serenity, Book of Equanimity, which was compiled by Hongzhi Zhengzhui, which was one of Domyo's Zen heroes, if you will. They're archaic and they're difficult to understand, they're really dense and enigmatic, and they make all these references that, 10th century Chinese monks would have gotten, but those of us here in modern day America may not fully understand. But I'm like, okay, you don't like koans, but we read Dogen. So you want to talk about enigmatic and confusing? I don't want to hear it about the koans if you're, into Dogen. But so it's not like we require complete and total simplicity and ease of understanding, right? So, but I think it helps to remember that koans aren't just these seemingly enigmatic teachings, teaching stories from ancient China. They're actually the everyday obstacles that we face in our practice, every single one of us. The things that force us to confront, things that perhaps we haven't wanted to confront, maybe we didn't know how to confront, maybe we don't even know we need to confront. They're the basic questions of our lives that, they kind of have no set answer because to one degree or another, the question points to the answer, or maybe it is the answer itself. The question that brings us face to face with our own suffering, with our karmic habitual ways of dealing with the world around us and how we perpetually get stuck. Now, I don't know about you, but I perpetually get stuck. So one thing that Domyo has emphasized from time to time and that I've discussed with her recently is what is my personal koan? And maybe some of you have had a similar conversation or similar thought, like what is my koan? Because we all have one. Or maybe if we're lucky, we have two or maybe three. Domyo discusses the idea of a personal koan in multiple episodes of the Zen Studies podcast, particularly episode 183, Natural Koans Engaging Our Limitations as Dharma Gates, where she says, quote, in the Soto Zen tradition, we say the koan arises in everyday life. So everything that we're facing day to day is in one way or another a koan of sorts. And it's been a topic raised in different Dharma discussions and practice groups and whatnot. So I'd like to take on the topic of the personal koan and my continuing search for identification of, struggles with, if you will, what my own personal koan might be. But before we get into what I think my koan is and how it manifests, I'd like to borrow a little bit from the Rinzai tradition and read someone else's koan. But I'm not going to, throw one of Mumon's koans at you with all sorts of references that nobody gets. I'm going to read a koan that really spoke to me and dovetails nicely into my topic for today from this book, The Book of Householder Koans, which was compiled by Eve Mionin Marco and Wendy Agyoku Nakao, the subtitle, Waking Up in the Land of Attachments. So what's really nice about this book is it it's the koans are modern stories, modern life, people who have jobs and kids and houses and stuff like that, and how those issues bump up against their practice, how their practice bumps up against those issues, and how they deal with them in the context of their Zen practice. So the koan that I'd like to read is called Roland, Stepping Backward. And there's a little quote here under the title. Now here you see it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. Which is from, why does this always, I can never remember the author's name, Lewis Carroll. I always want to say T.S. Eliot or C.S. Lewis. It's Lewis Carroll from Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There. So part of the whole Alice in Wonderland. Now here you see it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. I like that. That's pretty appropriate. Anyway, the koan. When Roland passed all his exams to become a doctor, he got sad, even depressed. There was no goal left. I felt useless. There was nothing driving me anywhere, Roland says. Many years later, combining a meditation and a homeopathic medicine practice, he says, quote, a step backward is a step forward. A step forward is a step backward. Commentary. We are so goal-oriented that life often appears to us as an arrow hurtling through the air to hit the bullseye. As long as we're on course, we're moving forward, but the minute we step off, if only to pause, it can feel like we're falling back. An old koan addresses this directly. Chao Cho once asked Nan Quan Puyuan, what is the way, or Tao? It says Tao here, but what is Tao, what is the way? Nan Quan answered, ordinary mind is the way. Then should we direct ourselves towards it or not? Asked Chao Cho. If you try to direct yourself towards it, you go away from it, answered Nan Quan. Chao Cho didn't give up. If we do not try, how can we know that it is the way? Isn't that what we naturally assume? If we don't try, how do we know that this is really it? If we don't set it up as a goal and then try our hardest, how will we get anywhere? In Zen, we don't try to get anywhere. Our practice is about closing gaps. The gap between yourself and your self, between you and me, between goal and practice, between the race and the finish line. The way does not belong to knowing or not knowing, Nan Quan informed Chao Cho. It does not lend itself to our daily bookkeeping of this plus this plus this equals that. If you can plunge into each step, you will find the treasure right there. In fact, you don't have to go anywhere. You can find the treasure right under your bare feet, right where you stand. A quote. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, for you, it is a good season. End quote. If you don't grasp at things, including goals and destinations, every day is a good day. That's fine, you might say, but we still need goals in life. Goals and priorities help us plan our day. But once we start an activity, we can put away the internal clock and slow down our striving. Let go of mental chatter and let the flow take over. Most important, drop the inner voices that crowd our consciousness, pushing, imploring, warning us to shape up, work hard, get ahead. We identify not just with our goal, but also with activity. Many of us get up in the morning and instantly go into work mode. Are you one of those people made anxious by vacation, afraid you won't make up the time or lack of effort, that unopened emails and unanswered phone messages will accumulate and you'll fall behind or miss out? How could we miss out if, moment by moment, nothing is missing? Quote, labor is a blessing, toil is the misery of man, end quote. Abraham Heschel, the 20th century Jewish philosopher, said this in his book on the Sabbath. These days, how many people take a full day off from checking emails? Taking a break feels like stepping backwards. In Zen, we pay attention to the body-mind. The mind alone is full of thoughts and manic whispers. But when I consult the body mind, the call may be to work, to take time out, to have a nap, to go for a walk, pick up a book, or play with the dog. Whatever you choose to do, actually do it. Do you experience what you're doing, or are you already thinking of the next step? Do you know where your feet and hands are at all times? A teacher can tell from a student's body language as they come for face-to-face study whether they're ahead of themselves, their mind's in forward motion, or whether they're centered and aware. Don't be propelled. As Nan Quan said to Chao Cho, ordinary mind is the way. There's nothing to make up, nothing to compete for, nothing to achieve. What in you does not believe that? What hungry ghost in you feels you must be more successful, more dedicated, more determined? That above all, you must always, always, always work harder. You cannot ignore or exclude this hungry ghost. It will not go away. If you try to feed it by working longer and longer hours, it will remain hungry and continue to tell you that something is always missing, that your life is still not it. Stop and listen carefully. Is anything really missing? Befriend the question. Befriend the ghost. Invite the ghost into the mandala of your practice and settle into the moment. Practice requires discipline and commitment, but not due to a sense of lack or failure. There is nothing to make up for. Excuse me. Roland now says, I am at home because I decided not to work anymore on Friday afternoon. The step backward is to be less successful and to get less money. But the step forward is to have more time for myself, for others, and for other parts of life. So this step backward is a step forward. We have a copy of this book in the library in the back if anyone's interested. It's really quite, it's been my nighttime reading. It's nice, they're nice and short, and I can drift off to sleep without feeling like I'm missing something. Excuse me. All the stagnant air, cold air is giving me bronchial issues, so I'm not sick. Don't anybody worry about me infecting you with something. Even those of you in the clouds, he's going to send germs through the microphone and get me sick. So, I'm sure that Roland's dilemma probably sounds somewhat familiar to most of us in one form or another. In the West, in America in particular, we've been raised in a culture that emphasizes hard work and achievement, that treats those who accomplish things and acquire labels and status, they get treated as heroes. And those who don't gather accolades or certifications or bragging rights are somehow less. How often do you meet someone new at a party or on an airplane, and one of the first questions they ask is, so what do you do? Anytime I'm asked that, I'm tempted to say something like, oh, I breathe, I eat, I sleep, take my meds, play with my kids, you know, the usual. I'm sure I'd get somewhat of a perplexed look if I answered like that, because that's not what the questioner meant. The questioner meant, what do you do for a living? How are you defined by the job you have, by the thing that makes you money, by the thing that occupies the most of your time? The questioner here is basically trying to find some common ground, some common foothold, in order to engage in a conversation that may lead to other more interesting or more meaningful things. But since we all work in some capacity, that can be a shared experience that we can often start with. But it can also be somewhat of a yardstick. What do you do, and how does that compare to what I do? And how much value do you have as a human being? Would the questioner be as interested in engaging me in conversation if they were some high-ranking executive at a company? And I said, oh, I'm unemployed, or I work at what they would consider to be a menial job. You know, I bag groceries at Safeway or something. To them, not as high status as their job. If they discovered that I did something where I had power, or there was complexity in my job, or was really interesting, would they be as interested in me if I didn't do those things? To use the classic motivational phrase used in business, they're kind of saying, what's in it for me to talk to you? What's the WIFM? W-I-I-F-M, WIFM. You know? If I engage you in conversation, any one of us could certainly answer their question and probably go on at length to some degree. You know, who are you? Well, if I have to answer that what do you do question, I am an adult education expert, curriculum designer, trainer, former college professor. I'm also a musician. I don't perform shows any longer, but I'm still a composer, recording artist, and all that type of thing. As anyone on the Sangha email list knows, since I send out emails about my stuff. But I'm also a father. I'm a husband. I'm an amateur chef. Almost went to culinary school. I am actually an amateur knitter with needles and yarn and the like. I can do scarves and hats. I have not worked up to socks and sweaters and the like. I can't follow a pattern. I don't have that kind of focus. You know. I like to be a world traveler. Traveled quite a bit. Got a trip to Japan planned for next year. I'm a former preacher's kid and current Zen Buddhist. If you ask my kids, I'm a general know-it-all and pain in the ass, but, you know, that's a different story. So while all of these things are me, do they define me? Are they who I am? Can my life truly be summarized in a lengthy paragraph I might trot out at a cocktail party or on an airplane? Or are they simply what I do or what I've done? All these things may sound great as some sort of a life resume, a list of things that a dying person might reflect on at the end of their life and say, yeah, I did some stuff, I did pretty well. But do those things define me? Or are they simply, as Roland discovered, steps forward and steps backwards? I don't know about you, but I felt like Roland before. Having accomplished something big, something important, I felt some sadness and despair. What do I do now? My whole identity was wrapped up in accomplishing this goal, and now that it's accomplished, I don't know what to do with myself. What's next? I sometimes wonder about people like me, or who I identify as, folks who have amassed a wide collection of skills and interests and all these things, you know, the polymaths, the Renaissance men or women, or whatever you would call them. Do I have this broad palette of knowledge because I'm truly hungry for knowledge and I want to live life to the fullest? Or am I just trying to keep myself occupied because I don't know what I would do with myself otherwise? Probably get into trouble. Or am I trying to make myself more interesting and relatable to others? I will admit, and I'm a little embarrassed to do so, but I'm doing it anyway. I found myself listing off all the things I've accomplished in my life in an attempt to kind of validate myself to myself, to make myself feel better about who I am. Not surprisingly, the times that I've done that, where I've gone through that mental list of accomplishments, has come at times when maybe I felt less than useful, less than wanted, less than needed. You remember that old skit on Saturday Night Live with Al Franken, where he played Stuart Smalley, looking at himself in the mirror and reciting positive affirmations to himself? That's probably what it looked like when I was going through my list. I'm strong enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. So as alluded to earlier in a recent discussion with Domio, we were discussing what my personal koan might be. What is it that I bump up against the most? What is the underlying obstacle in the way of my awakening? What is the primary thrust of my karmic habitual energy? What is it that is so pervasive and subtle that it can be very difficult to truly see for what it is? What is my primary koan that arises in everyday life, as she said? I offered up to her that it probably has something to do with identity, cultivating and protecting a sense of who I am as it differentiates me from who you are. Domio then suggested that perhaps my koan is around the topic of I am what I do. Or to paraphrase the French philosopher René Descartes, I do, therefore I am. Or facio ergo sum, if you like the Latin, cogito ergo sum. And when she said that, that actually really hit home to me, because it really helps to kind of summarize decades of activity, decades of samsara, decades of karmic habit energies that have kept me spinning around and around for a long time. I spent many years amassing that resume that I just listed and all of the details of that, only to realize that a lot of it, particularly around my various musical professional accomplishments, was empty. And I don't mean the good empty of shunyata. I'm not talking about emptiness as we talk about it. I'm talking about lacking any real substance or meaning. A thing done not for the sake of itself or for the sake of others or to solve some problem, but a thing done simply to have another feather in the cap, another notch on the spear. I spent years running around, involving myself in so many different projects. So many different projects. I used to listen. So what band, how many bands are you playing in? Oh, well, I'm playing in about 10 bands right now. Like every weekend was just packed with gigs, you know, just playing, just darting around. You know. What outfit do I have to wear to this gig? And see, oh, I need to invest in a tie. Okay, this one's casual and this, you know. So it was just make your head spin. I was trying to reinvent myself every time and create something new, not for the sake of contributing to the world in a positive way necessarily, although I might have done so by accident, but it was always grasping for that next brass ring, always trying to earn another merit badge, if you will, that would differentiate me from everyone else who hadn't accomplished the things that I had accomplished and didn't have that particular merit badge. So why expend all of this energy towards doing something that's for the wrong reason? Well, I didn't think it was the wrong reason. I thought it was the right reason. And it's pretty obvious. It was approval, validation. Stacking myself up against everyone else, measuring my achievements and my status compared to others who I felt were above, beneath, or maybe alongside me. Feeling that lift of pride and self-worth and place and meaning when I realized, oh, I'm respected or wanted or admired or valued. And I felt a little despondent or lost when I realized, oh, I'm not getting the response that I'm really looking for here. Okay, trying to change gears now. This didn't work, let's jump on to the next thing and see if that works instead. Not content to just be in the world and of the world and responding to the world, but needing to set up a dichotomy of self and others so that myself, small self, could get a gold star or maybe a red star, you know, while everybody else is getting a red star and green stars, or maybe they weren't getting any stars at all. It came from a place of lack, where I was trying to fill that gilded box with the next shiny object, more valuable, more meaningful than the rest. My daughter is 7 years old, and so she's a big fan of Disney movies, and she really likes Moana. So those of you who don't know anything about, I'm going to lose you with this reference, but in the Moana movie, there's a giant crab named Tamatoa that lives in the realm of monsters. And he's on his shell, he's huge. He's like the size of this room. And he's got all these shiny objects, gold and silver coins and silver chalices and cups and the fishhook of Maui, the demigod who's, you know, in the story. And the reason that he covers himself in all these shiny objects, and the reason why he loves to talk about himself, his character in the movie just loves to talk about himself, it's an attempt to make himself shiny and beautiful because inside he doesn't really feel loved. That's the subtext of it. I have been this giant animated crap from time to time. What I didn't realize at the time was that every step forward in big air quotes, stepping forward into some new endeavor, some new achievement, was in fact somewhat of a step backward. Stepping forward into who I thought I needed to be, backward away from who I really was. Stepping forward into something that would bring me more suffering and backward away from equanimity and peace. I had to laugh a little bit as I was writing all of this out because this idea of forward and backward that I just referenced and as is suggested in the koan that I read, the Roland koan in the book, actually aligns with our Western ideals of progress and regress, right? Where achievement and success are seen as making progress and moving forward, and losing stature or wealth is seen as regress or moving backward. And I laughed because this is the exact opposite motion that Dogen Zenji uses in the Fukan Zazengi, where he admonishes us to take the backward step and turn the light around to illuminate the self. I have to say I like Dogen's take, and I really relate to Dogen's take, because for many years, my attempts to make progress, to always move forward, to move the needle up, moving forward into who I thought I needed to be, was in fact moving forward into delusion and ignorance. Moving forward and outward into a shell of who I thought I needed to be. I've almost imagined it at times like it was a costume that I stepped into every morning and I wore around all day, hoping that I would fool others into believing that this is who I really was, hoping that I would fool myself into believing that this is who I really was. As mentioned in the commentary in Roland's koan, this was a me getting ahead of myself, always thinking of the next big thing, rather than being centered and grounded right here. In Dogen's paradigm, he suggests that it's better to go backward, to stop reaching 3 feet out in front of ourselves for something unattainable, always casting about for the next thing that's going to make us happy. We become, as the wonderful reference in Mumon's commentary on case one of the Gateless Gate, the famous Joshu's dog. We become phantoms clinging to trees and grass. I love that imagery. I'm just flitting about, always clinging to something that's ultimately not the answer. Always moving around. When instead we should sit still, step backward, return to reality, return to the self with a capital S.
Right, just this way. Yeah, okay.
This imagery of the backward step is really powerful to me because for all those years, I really did feel like I was living 3 feet outside of myself. Literally wearing a mask of someone accomplished and competent and trying to outwardly present myself as something that perhaps deep down I didn't really feel was the truth. And that dichotomy between who we are and who we want to be and who we don't want to be and who we pretend to be and who we think we really are and all that, that push and pull is what causes our dukkha. I was relieved to hear Domio echo a similar sentiment in an old podcast episode from 2017, episode number 13, like one of the first ones, what Zen acceptance and non-attachment really are. And she says, quote, "I start creating suffering, at least for myself, when I tie my sense of self to my efforts. My sense that I am substantial, worthy, effectual, safe, and or connected with other beings becomes tangled up with the situation I am trying to address, with my opinions, intentions, and ideals, and with the resistance I face in my efforts to change what's happening. In my internal narrative about myself and the world, I have to succeed, or else. The alternative, not succeeding, is completely unacceptable. I get discouraged or angry unless the changes I'm working for come fast enough to meet my standards. The possibility of a disastrous outcome casts a pall over my whole life." Yeah, I have definitely felt that pall. What I'm doing isn't working. What am I going to do now? So what was I afraid of? What are we all afraid of at different times of our lives that causes us to go down this road and causes our dukkha? I think ultimately for me, I was afraid of loneliness, not just loneliness in regards to other people, but even loneliness being with myself, being alone with myself. A therapist could probably identify, and has actually, specific moments in my life that probably embedded this feeling in me, the fact that my childhood was marked by frequent moves to different cities and states every year. I was in a different school every year, sometimes twice a year. My dad kept getting different ministerial assignments in the church denomination that he was in. So I never had stability between the ages of 5 and 13, and never could make friends, you know, all that type of thing. And then my parents divorced when I was 13, so that probably has something to do with it. I developed a fear of just being with my own thoughts and fears and regrets. I didn't want to step backward into myself because I didn't really like myself. I didn't even know who myself was. My identity relied on feedback from others, engagement with others, constantly needing someone telling me that I was strong enough, smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. So where is that guy now? Well, he's still there. He's a little smaller. He's quieter. He speaks up far less. He's mostly been humbled by the recognition of who he really is. The emperor, who once believed he was wearing the finest garments, but now looking in the mirror realizes he's buck naked. Every once in a while he forgets. Of course, that's why we have the practice. He tries to make something of himself where no one needs to be made. He forgets he has nothing to do and no one to be other than his own real self with a capital S. It's difficult, of course, as Roland came to realize, to find that balance between just enough ego identity to survive and thrive, and more importantly, contribute where one is needed most, and a mad descent into arrogance and selfishness, where selfish truly meaning, you know, primarily concerned with oneself, and screw the rest of you guys. It's one thing to constantly try, as it was my case, to constantly try to market myself in the music industry and be a superstar and suck up all the energy from enthusiastic crowds and all that. But even here, even right here in this room, at Brightway Zen, even in the context of this practice that's teaching me to let go of identity, I'm constantly doing. I'm on the board. I head up the Doan team, you know, all the chanting and the timekeeping and all that. I'm organizing the Sharon and Sangha night. I helped figure out all this, put together all this technology that allows us to have a cloud Zendo. I'm usually the first when Domio says, "Hey, anybody like to give a talk?" I'm like, you know, like almost instantly. Like, wait, I'm still doing. What am I trying to prove? You know. A few years ago when I first came to Brightway Zen to a Saturday just sitting, when we actually had them here in the room instead of in the cloud, I showed up and I had been practicing with no rank Zendo. Richard and crew over there. And I came here for the first time. And so I showed up in the prescribed black attire, and I had my shaved head, and I've got my, you know, Bodhisattva vow tattooed on my arm, all that kind of thing. And Bruce, where's Bruce? There he is, right in front of me. Bruce, I never forget this. Bruce looks right at me and he says, "Are you one of those Zen guys?"
I remember that.
I do. I remember it all right. Because it stuck with me for years, because my reaction at the time, and even my reaction now, is, oh my gosh, he saw through me. You know, he's like, am I trying to pretend to be a Zen guy? What am I doing right now? You know? And so it made me think, you know, it made me reflect on, well, am I still, like, is this, even this, is it still part of the problem? Am I still trying to pretend to be somebody that maybe I'm not? Or am I just trying to blend in? Which that was, I landed on, well, I'm just trying to blend in, because at no rank, you know, there's kind of a more standard way of, at least there was back when I was going there, that was more standard way of dressing. I showed up one night, I was wearing socks. I know. Nobody's like, oh no! Yeah, and I went to Dokusan, and Osho was like, we don't wear socks here, barefoot, unless you have a medical condition that requires you to wear socks. Okay. So, a little more standard attire at no rank. So I came here thinking that maybe you guys did that too, and I realized very quickly that you really don't. So that's cool. You know, I like that. But it made me think, like, was I still pretending to be somebody I'm not, or was I just trying to fit in, blend in with the standard? You know, what's the expectation? Maybe a bit of both. And that's part of my koan too. So activity, activity, activity. Doing, 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 doing. For what purpose? Well, is it the activity that's the problem? Or is it the primary motivating factor behind the activity? And for many years, it really was the primary motivating factor was just, you know, needing validation, needing approval, needing to be somebody because I wasn't comfortable with who I was. But what about here? You know, what's the motivating factor? Why do I do what I do? Am I trying to prove something to everyone, to Domyo, to you? Or am I just trying to contribute something meaningful and helpful to this Sangha? Well, it can't be activity in and of itself. We know that because right there, in one of the most fundamental teachings of all of Buddhism anywhere, is the Eightfold Path and the sixth step, right effort. So there must be a difference between wrong effort and right effort, right? Yes. So how can I tell the difference? And what do I do when I identify the differences? How can I practice right effort instead of the wrong effort that's marked so much of my life? Lama Karma Yeshe Chodron had this definition of right effort in a recent Lion's Roar article. She says, quote, "Right translates the Pali word sama, meaning complete, genuine, imperfect harmony. It connotes to right, as in to restore to an accurate position, in alignment with what is true, like an arrow, instrument, or the wheel that is finely crafted, even keeled, and fit for its purpose." The English word effort renders the Pali word vayama. So in the Pali, right effort is samavayama. It means to extend, stretch, exert energy, train, and fathom, as in the distance indicated by outstretched arms, as well as the act of measuring that span. It's kind of cool. But I love this notion of right effort being activity that is aligning with what is true. It's not a state of being. It's a process of constantly righting ourselves, of constantly steering the rudder of our ship just enough so that we can stay aligned with the stars, to keep that compass point, that compass needle going in the direction that we want to go in. And if we stray far off course, spinning that wheel with all our might to get back on track and head in the direction that we want to travel. So how do we do this? Fortunately for us, Buddhism is one of the most categorical spiritual systems there are, and there's a list for everything. The Pali Canon has a list in the context of right effort called the Four Exertions. This is a translation by Tanisiro Bhikkhu, otherwise known as Ajahn Jeff, from Metaphorist Monastery down in San Diego area. This is from the Sunyutta Nikaya 45.8. 1. There is the case where a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent, for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. They generate desire, endeavor, activate persistence, uphold, and exert their intent for the sake of the abandonment of evil, unskilled qualities that have arisen. They generate desire, endeavor, activate persistence, uphold, and exert their intent for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. And they generate desire, endeavor, activate persistence, uphold, and exert their intent for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This, monks, is called right effort. So there's a lot of words in there, and it's very repetitive, as the Pali Canon usually is, but it really comes down to evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, recognizing them for what they are, dealing with evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen, recognizing and cultivating skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and then maintaining skillful qualities that have arisen. So you got the two parts. You got unskillful qualities, you got to recognize them before they happen, and then you got to deal with them when they do. And then skillful qualities, you try to recognize them and cultivate them before they arise, and then you try to maintain them when they do arise. So it's a little formulaic thing. You see that constantly throughout the Pali Canon. So of course, all of this requires the ability to recognize what is defined as evil, unskillful qualities. Well, what do we mean by that term? If we can't even see our ignorance and delusion for what they are, well, we don't even stand a chance, right? We just keep stumbling blindly and selfishly through life, causing and feeling suffering along the way. And this is where the Bodhisattva precepts and the vow, the Bodhisattva vow, can be so helpful. Right effort basically involves making sure we take care of others, we honor others, we speak truthfully and with good intention, we stay humble and chaste, and do only that which is of benefit to all beings, sentient and non-sentient, for the sake of saving all beings. Once we can identify where we get hung up, then we can practice those four exertions: seeing the unskillful actions before they arise, abandon them once they arise, and then realign towards skillful action, and maintaining and increasing skillful action. So for me, this manifested as realizing that much of my activity and effort wasn't aligned towards what was true. It was aligned towards ego identity, towards gain and praise, towards building up a self. Whatever it cost, whoever got hurt along the way was collateral damage. So the first big step was the second exertion, stopping the unskillful qualities that had already arisen and that were my modus operandi for all intents and purposes. And that meant for me, in practical terms, I basically tanked my musical career. Like literally overnight, I just quit everything, stopped everything. And then that allowed me, once I got to that place of quiet, that allowed me to practice the third and fourth exertions, realigning towards positive, nurturing, helpful actions, taking care of my family first and foremost, refocusing my creative energies on endeavors that truly spoke to my innermost expression and not to my outermost image. And then that, of course, allowed me to practice the fourth exertion, where it's just all about keeping that ship righted. Seeing myself take a slight left or a slight right turn here or there, and turning that wheel, turning that rudder. Always striving to notice that I'm off course and realigning with what is good and true. So was all of that somewhat of a step backward? Of course, like Roland, I sacrificed a fairly successful and highly visible career for the sake of being home on a Friday night with my wife and kids, just like he did. But like Roland, I don't regret it in the least. My wife even has a habit of asking me from time to time, "Do you miss it?" And there's always that subtext of, because I don't believe that you don't miss it. You did it for so long, and it was such a major part of your life, I can't believe that you miss it. And I say, without hesitation, I say, I do not miss it at all. I would not go back to it, because I know why I used to do it, and I don't like the guy that used to do it, so why would I miss being the guy that used to, you know, so. And so I come back around to my own personal koan. For years, I struggled with what I did being an outward expression of identity, an identity I was desperate to cling to, where doing was merely in the service of personal gain, and the self I was expressing was really the small self. Now I think, to what degree can doing still be an outward expression of myself, but this time with a capital S, my true self, the self that is not separate from others, that is comfortable just being? Indeed, discovering that it's the whole universe and all things manifesting as themselves at every moment and just doing the next thing that needs doing and nothing more. If, in fact, my personal koan is that I am what I do, or I do therefore I am, then at least this practice helps me make sure that I'm only doing what is absolutely necessary, doing just the next thing that helps all beings with very little thought for gain and fame and not worrying about how it advances my stature or earns me a gold star. Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of great activity, whose name we chant in the meal chant at Zazen Kai and Sesshin. As the bodhisattva of great activity, he's responsible for practice, meditation, and action. So that seems like a pretty good role model for right effort, right? Yeah. Good. In the Lotus Sutra, Samantabhadra recites the Bhadrakari Frangidana. I can never say that right. Which is basically the vows of good conduct. And includes these 10 great vows. To pay homage to all the Buddhas. To glorify the qualities of all the Tathagatas. To make ample offerings to all the Buddhas. To confess and repent of all of one's misdeeds. To rejoice in the merits of others. To always request preaching on the Dharma. To entreat enlightened beings to remain in the world. To always study the teachings of the Buddha. To always respond to sentient beings according to their various needs, and to dedicate all merits to sentient beings so that they may achieve Buddhahood. So by my reckoning, I am working on numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 8 by practicing here, paying homage to Buddhas, glorifying qualities of Tathagatas, making ample offerings, etc., etc. By studying with you, listening to my teacher, practicing in Sangha with everyone here. But it's really numbers 5, 9, and 10, rejoicing in the merits of others, responding to sentient beings according to their various needs, and dedicating all merits to sentient beings that they may achieve Buddhahood. Those are up to me to enact outside of these walls. For me to fulfill in my daily life, as I work with my personal koan, I do, therefore I am. All right, that was a lot of words. Now it'd be nice to hear some words from you, if you have them, questions or comments. If you're here in the dirt, you can come to the questioner's chair in the cloud, just do a little raise your hand icon. Exhausted everyone with all my yakking.
You've just given us a lot to think about. We're thinking.
Oh, good. Here comes Jim, though. He's already thought it all through.
I'm not sure I've got a question. I've got a piece of the... I have a piece of the puzzle which I'm trying to figure out how it fits in, which is there can be times when I pick up a role and express, put on a costume in order to, you know, achieve the little gold star and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there are times when we pick up a costume and we put on the costume not for a gold star for ourselves, but that's the role that we're taking, or that's something that we do that we, and I guess the challenge is knowing that you have picked up this costume, put on this costume, and being aware, being careful about being attached to the outcome of that. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I agree. And that, like you referenced earlier, like that's that first step, right? That recognition, that ability to even be self-aware enough to say, oh, I'm doing this thing for this reason, and here's where I could get stuck, or here's where I could get hung up, you know. So I've got to be careful of that, and I got to just do what needs to be done for this, you know. Like just even having that cognizance is, I mean, that puts us, any of us that have that ability, to like, oh, why am I, you know, puts us miles ahead of most, you know, of everyone else in the world that just kind of grabs the next thing and, okay, this is what I want to be, this is what I want to do now, you know. It's very interesting. Thank you. Dave.
This might not be one of those yes or no answer questions, but it's something that occurred to me while you were talking. I'm a big fan of Joko Beck. Different people have different opinions. I think she's a badass. So, but she talks about a core belief. People have a core belief that at the base. It's very psychological in that way. There's a something that's sort of like driving you, and you have to dig down to it and find it. Do you, when you are talking about personal koans, do you envision it more like something that is like that, like something that persists from your childhood through your life? Or do you imagine it more like something that is like, oh, I've got this personal koan now, and then I got that one, I'm going to go to the next personal koan, right? I don't know.
Yeah, and thanks for the question, Dave. Yeah. It might be different for different people. I mean, for me, just because of my familial and cultural and societal background, educational background, all that, it you know, manifested as, you know, that like wanting to impress people, you know, was really like the main koan of my life. You know, is there more to it? You know, that, and it's like, okay, well, if that motivated me to act in a way that was maybe beneficial to myself, but was it beneficial to them ever? Well, sure, it was. So can I take that and now just turn it on its head a little bit and say, well, let's take out the selfish component and let's take that same drive to like, I want to do for you, you know, I want to be here for you, and take out that piece that says, I want to be here for you because then you'll love me, and just take out that last bit. And said, no, I just want to be here for you, whether or not you care, whether or not you love me, whether or not it means anything. I'm just practicing that bodhisattva vow to just be present, you know, and to work for the sake of all sentient beings. Right? So I feel like for me, I mean, I'm going to turn 56 in a couple of weeks. So I think for me, that's like my main gone. I don't know if there's any other, but there might be others that have had different types of experiences, different types of trauma they might have. More than one, not really, you know, and to what degree do those dovetail with each other though, right? So maybe they are one, but it seems like two. And yeah, I guess you could work on one big thing and kind of say, okay, got that one done, push that aside. Oh, here's another challenging situation. But that's not how it's been for me, but I'm sure others have had that.
Dave, I got a question.
Yes, sir.
So, is answering the koan the answer?
Still working on it. The answer to the koan? Still working on it. I do, therefore I am. Yeah. I think.
That's a general question for everyone, right?
Question.
Yeah.
Does it, in other words, I mean, do you really have to answer it, or is this just starting your investigation?
Or are you just starting the process again?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, I feel like in a lot of ways the question itself is part of the answer. You know, like it probably is with a lot of things. Like, if that's what's getting in the way of my fully committing to selflessness, you know, it's going to take a lot of what they like in the Pali Canon say uprooting the fetters. Like, there's all these deeply ingrained habit energies that are there. So, you know, it's about, do I even see it when I bump up against it? How well do I recognize it? How well do I work with that? Or how often do I just continue stumbling blindly through it? You know, so, yeah, TBD. Probably just be working on that one for the rest of my days. Yeah. John. Morning, John.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you for that talk.
very heartfelt and very well executed. So one of the questions I have is, it's kind of like you're judging what you did in the past, like wrong effort. Now you have right effort. And I kind of ask, was it really wrong effort? Or maybe, it was right effort, but for the wrong reasons and all that kind of stuff. And then you have to ask, am I doing the right stuff now? Right? I mean, you've got different reasons. Your reasons have changed and it's maybe less self-centered and whatever, but you're still doing it for a reason, right? It's almost like all of it is right. Reality provides us reasons, whatever they are, and heads us in a direction. And maybe we're still heading there. Anyway, I wouldn't want you to look back on your past effort as wrong effort, because, for example, musicians everywhere create just beautiful stuff for all of us. And I don't care what their reasons are for. They did what they do well. And that's what makes the world beautiful. So, anyway.
Thank you, John. For the sake of sending the wrong message, I mean, obviously in this context, there's only so much I can really say. But yeah, it definitely wasn't all wrong, but I definitely had moments where I compared myself. Like, I've got friends who are professional musicians here in Portland area, very well known and all that. And they post on Facebook, he's like, I spent 4 hours today woodshedding this John Coltrane tune in all 12 keys. And I'm like, you did what? Like, to me, that was like, why would you do that? But it was because he has such a love for the music itself. Like, it was really like he didn't give a crap what anybody else thought, right? I mean, maybe he posted that to be like, I'm such the cool jazz nerd, I don't know, maybe not, but it really was just about, I want to play the music for the sake of the music. And I certainly have had a lot of that in my life. But there was always this, the steering wheel was not completely geared towards the love of the music. That wasn't the destination. It was just love of the music. It was, okay, yeah, that's cool. The music is awesome. And I love making music and I love playing music, but what's going to put me in front of the most people? What's going to, So there was always like this patina over anything that I did that was more self-centered. Even if the action itself of playing music with others and creating music and all that type of thing, even if that was perfectly valid and wonderful, there was always this like extra motivation to be something more, And you reference like my reasons have changed. Yeah, my reasons have changed. I still do music, right? So I stopped playing live shows because I realized the only I'm well, 75% of the reason that I played live shows was because I like to be in front of people and I like doing the thing. 25% of it was like, it was fun to engage with other musicians and play really cool music. And I was in this band for a while here in Portland called the Shanghai Woolies that does like early jazz. And it was so fun to do the like standard Louis Armstrong, like just complete straight up ape Louis Armstrong style. It was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. But that wasn't always the primary motivation behind it, So now, yeah, my reasons have changed. Now I'm just making music at home, right? I'm doing my own thing. I'm recording my albums, writing music. And I'll have those moments where I'm like, well, maybe I should bring in this guest artist person to really make this track. And then I realize, like, wait, why do I need to do that? I don't really care what anybody thinks. I'm not doing this for anybody else, And I've looked at my whatever, the number of people that listen to the tracks or bought the albums or whatnot. And I'm like, and I'll have these moments like, oh, I wish it was selling better. And I'm like, wait a minute. I really don't care if anybody buys it. That's not my primary motivation. My primary motivation is to make the music that comes out of me. So for the first time in my life, I really feel like my intentions are not tainted by that seeking approval piece of it. Now my intentions are more pure for just, around this creating the music for the sake of the music. And that's not to say that anything I did in the past was, suspect or was low quality. Just I know where a lot of that motivation was coming from. And that's now gone, or much less of the motivation than it was before. So yeah, I'm not beating myself up. Don't worry.
I'm glad people have that motivation because it puts them out in front. So if you get that motivation back, we'll still like you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that, John. All right. As if there's nothing else, and it's time, so I'll go ahead and close this thing out. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha discussion to all so that they may be able to attain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.